This podcast of Left, Right, and Center is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Who is John Murtha, and how did he rock the Iraq debate? Plus, the White House fights back, Bush's world tour, and Bob Woodward's other secret. Hello again and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the screaming talking heads that dominate political debate. I'm Matt Miller, columnist for Fortune magazine and senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, holding down the center here on Left, Right, and Center. Bob Scheer, our usual left, is away today. He is on board the Nation magazine cruise, and he will be back next week. On the right, Tony Blankley will be joining us. He's our editorial page editor and columnist for the Washington Times. And, of course, beyond these stale categories, but perhaps since Bob is on the Nation cruise, acting as a true progressive, not just from the blogosphere, but from the print and real world, is our own Arianna Huffington, editor-in-chief of the Washington Post, of the Huffington Post. I've given you, I don't know, would that be a promotion, Arianna, or just a...
Not during the Bob Woodward week. I think at any other week, yes.
Anyway, it's a big week this week, and Arianna and I, you and I will be in dialogue a little bit about it alone, because Tony Blankley has been caught in nefarious Washington traffic, I think, getting to the studio. This is one of the perils of live radio, or at least live-to-tape radio, depending on where you're listening. But the top of the news as we went to air was that John Murtha, not a congressman that people, my guess, would have lots of name recognition for and had focused on much before a stunning speech that he made on Thursday this week, but someone who has been himself a Marine veteran, who had been a strong supporter of our military, someone who Republicans have counted on for years in terms of military matters and foreign policy, came out and called for withdrawal from Iraq, saying that the war in Iraq is not going advertised. It is a flawed policy wrapped in an illusion, and that at this point, because we have become the main target, he thinks at this point we are doing more harm than good, and we are not doing right by our troops by keeping them there. This has sparked lots of reaction. But, Arianna, why don't you start off and share what you think this means and where it's headed?
I think it's incredibly important, Matt. I mean, this is a real turning point in the way the war is perceived, unlike any other. And what makes it that is that, as you said, this is the most hawkish Democrat. This is a veteran with two purple hearts and one bronze star. This is a man who was visibly moved as he was speaking. This is clearly not a politically expedient decision. It comes from his own incredible concern for the troops. And that's why when he said that the United States needs to redeploy immediately, when he said no schedule which can be changed, nothing that's controlled by the Iraqis, this is an immediate redeployment of our American forces because they have become the target, it had a kind of urgency and a kind of passion and a kind of demonstration of true leadership that, as you said, has rocked the Iraq debate and is in sharp contrast to what other Democrats are doing, including the former president, Bill Clinton, who said in Dubai that the war was a terrible mistake, but said nothing else. He didn't say he changed his mind. He didn't say, therefore, we need to do X and Y. It was the same kind of triangulation that Clinton is so good at. And then we had Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid coming out and attacking the Bush White House for attacking the congressman, but not really endorsing him, not really validating what he's saying. So it's a powerful moment, unlike any other, as I said. And the attempts of the White House to try and swift boat him, to try and link him to Michael Moore, to the liberal left, all the usual sound bites are not going to work because it's so clear that that's not who he is. It's so clear that this is a man who had voted with the administration for every military appropriation, who had been the staunchest supporter of the war, and who, as he said, is now seeing that we have become the target and we are enabling the insurgency.
Well, I'm looking at his speech and just wanted to share a little bit of it because when you think about it, he was someone who supported the war, and he's someone – so it's not the what's different about the quality of what his stepping out means is it's not someone who was a opponent from the beginning. But he says things like, you know, we spend more money on intelligence than all the countries in the world together, more on intelligence than most countries' GDP. It's not a world intelligence failure. It was a U.S. intelligence failure and the way that intelligence was misused. But, I mean, he goes on to say, and Tony, I know you're with us, so let me tee it up to you, that,
yes,
that at this point, while he supported it at the time, we're not going to – we can't do more, and it's we've gotten ourselves in a situation where we can't do more than what we've done, and being there longer is worse.
Well,
what do you know,
I mean – well, he said in September of 2003, and it was reported in Roll Call, which is a paper that covers Congress, that the war was unwinnable. That's the word he used in September of 2003, 2 years ago. In 2004, in a press conference with the stateswoman, what's her name, the speaker, the minority leader of the House, They held a press conference in which he announced that he was for pulling out unless we had a massive increase in troop strength, so that he has a long track record of doubting the plausibility of this. He does have, prior to this war, in the previous 30 years he's been in Congress, he's been a very solid man for defense, and there's no way around that. I know the man. I remember his voting record through the 90s, and he was a pro-defense spender and a man who paid attention to the concerns of the military. So that's certainly a big part of his record. But I must say that, at least going back to two years now, back to 2003, he's been basically being a defeatist since then, at least.
And
but,
so that...
But, you know,
go ahead, Daria.
Yeah, Tony, I don't know why that in any way discredits him. I mean, you can call it defeatist. Others can call it realist. I mean, after all, the facts have
proven
him
debate.
Right.
No, the facts haven't proven right. But that's
all
the
I'm
debate.
Saying is...
One at a time. Let's have Ariana then.
Yeah, I mean, it's like saying that anybody who objected to the pre-war WMD intelligence was against the military or against invading. Or somehow the fact that people were right, either because they didn't believe the WMD intelligence or because they said 2 years ago that the war is unwinnable, which we are now finding out it is, only makes them more credible to me. It means that they are looking at what the real evidence is, what the real facts are, instead of buying the Pentagon line.
Well, if it's my turn,
yes.
I don't think that it is empirically obvious that we are losing this war. I know you can stake that, and you may be right, you may be wrong. I'm going to be running an article next week by a Marine sergeant in the field. His name will not go published. And he describes from a grunt's point of view how he sees the war going on. And he has his complaints about various things. It's an uncensored assessment of one of our young men who's just in there fighting every day. I think we get a very distorted vision of how things are going along. My sense, and I've talked to a lot of people who have come back from Iraq, is that the men and women who are fighting there are feeling pretty good about how things are going, while we here on the stateside are seeing nothing but bad news. Now, there's no doubt that they've been completely unable to stop the suicide bombing. That is the conspicuous success of the terrorists. On the other hand, we have election after election in which the Iraqi people are vigorously participating. All factions are continuing to try to resolve their disputes about how to form a new government through the political process. This is an extraordinary success that people who are against the war at the beginning predicted would never be able to happen. They said the factions would never sit down and talk. Well, they are sitting down, and they are talking, and they are making compromises. So it's a mixed bag, and I think it's far too soon to presume that this effort is not going to be successful. Now, I say people can differ on that, yep, but keep in mind that we're all working off of a very ambiguous bit of data as we try to get it from 8,000 miles away about what's actually happening there.
Let me ask this, because, I mean, there may be other people out there who are in the situation I find myself in, trying to think this through, which is, I supported the war because I thought they had weapons of mass destruction. Once it became clear that they didn't have weapons of mass destruction, I feel perfectly, I feel sure that if we had known that in advance, I would not have supported the war. But I remain very sort of confused about how to think about, once we're there, how to leave without leaving a worse mess, and how to assess whether we would leave a worse mess or whether there's light at the end of the tunnel somewhere. And I guess I agree with Tony in the sense that I don't feel like I have a sense from, you know, I'm not on the ground there. I don't do reporting in Iraq, and I don't know from what I read, you know, how to think about whether there's a way out. All right, maybe you guys can take a shot at persuading me either way.
Well,
as a proxy, you know, for people more important, like, you know, the American people.
Ariana, you first.
Thank you, Tony. Well, first of all, there is no question that if you look at the facts of what the insurgency is doing, who they are targeting, that our presence there, including the fact that the way the military is behaving, even by the people who are most pro-military, they know that every time they go into a town there and they raid people's homes and they act in the way that the military has to act, I presume, you know, even in the best of circumstances. This is not a force that is being loved even by people who want us there in Iraq. So we don't really need to argue that, in my opinion. I mean, you see again and again, and we hear it even from people like Ahmad Chalabi, who wants the military to stay there very badly. But when I met with him in New York, he was saying again and again how the presence of the military is feeding the insurgency. And that's why he's asking for the military to operate within their law, to operate the way they're operating in Germany or 100 other countries where we have a military presence, instead of the way they're operating in Iraq, where they don't have to follow the agreements they have to follow in other countries, where they're basically operating as an occupying force. So why don't we just look at that fact? If you have a military operating as an occupying force, it's going to feed the insurgency. It's going to feed those who want to demonize Americans and want to get us out of there as fast as possible.
But if we leave, I guess this is my question, and I'll come back to you, Tony, but probably after our break. I guess if you're a reasonable person who's not sure what the answer is here, what would you say to someone who's worried that if we leave, it's going to descend into total civil war and chaos and leave things, except for having, you know, gotten rid of Saddam Hussein, totally negating the lives and the $300 billion that we've put in? How would you answer that?
Well, let me say.
I actually wanted to hear Ariana first on that.
Oh, okay.
Because I just want to hear, and then we'll break, and then we'll hear Tony.
Well, first of all, I would say that the way we are doing it now is only going to get worse. That there is no time at which it's going to be good enough for us to leave. I have no question about that. There is no time at which the Iraqi forces will be ready to take over, as the White House and others are claiming, and the military can withdraw without the danger that you are actually predicting right now, Matt. So what will happen when the military leaves is, I think, just as uncertain as what is happening with the military there, except that right now we know for sure that we're feeding the insurgency.
Up ahead, the last word on Iraq. The White House fights back, plus Bob Woodward's other secret. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Find more Left, Right, and Center programs and podcasts at kcrw.com.
Again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Matt Miller in the center in Los Angeles. Tony Blankley is on the right in Washington, D.C. Bob Scheer is away today on the Nation Cruise, but he'll be back next week. And Ariana Huffington from Las Vegas today is occupying the broad progressive swath of the show. Tony Blankley, we're finishing, at least for this week, on Iraq. How would you answer, since I'm playing the voice of the muddled middle in America, that if the worry might be for your position, which is we need to see our way through, What's the answer to those who say, "My God, this thing's going to be this thing's going to go on for 15 years, and it's just going to be endless suicide bombings, and we got ourselves into something we didn't fully understand, and there's little hope of getting it right"?
Well, Ariana's statement that no matter how long we stay, the Iraqis won't be able to get into a better position, I don't think is supportable either in logic or in fact. The Iraqi military, which was down to zero when we disbanded it, and after a very rocky start at trying to reorganize it, is now up to somewhere in the vicinity of 200,000 effective soldiers and security forces. It's not enough. But they picked up 200,000 in really about a year and a half of serious effort. Another year, a year and a half, 2 years, could easily get that number up to 400,000 or 500,000. It's a population of 25 million. They've got plenty of people, plenty of young men available, and willing and ever more willing to recruit and join and be properly trained. It takes a while to train a military force. So the fact is that more time will buy a better chance for the Iraqis to be able to defend themselves. Ultimately, if years from now they can't, well, that's another matter. I think there's another huge issue here that we have to accept, that whether one agrees with the war or not, getting into it or not, that is now a done deal. We fought the war. I was for it. I continue to be for it. By the way, in my column before the war in September of 2002, I warned that we were going to be facing a prolonged struggle to defeat the will of an aroused and myriad people. We were entering a time of measureless peril. So I was not one of the cakewalk people back then. But
you were one of the measureless peril people.
I was the measureless peril guy, which was, by the way, the line that Winston Churchill used shortly before World War II, that we were entering a period of measureless peril. So I recognized the danger. I never thought it was going to be clean. But the fact is that if we were to leave and be seen to be pushed out, which is what would happen if we left any time soon, this would be a catastrophic propaganda victory for the terrorists and bin Laden. And they have shown, in fact, one of the few things that bin Laden has consistently actually said himself is that what encourages him is our constant willingness to retreat, whether it's from Lebanon in 83 or Mogadishu, or whether it's our failure to respond to the first World Trade bombing or the other bombings in Saudi Arabia and Africa, that was an example of why we were a decadent West and it should encourage young radical Islamists to go on jihad. So we would only be encouraging vastly that if we were at this point to turn tail and run. I think that, and we need, and I'm not talking about looking for a decent interval, which was an indecent interval, which we found in Vietnam. We need to persist, and I think we have a reasonable chance of persisting, building up the Iraqi force, and being able to establish an operation that is much better than the condition was before we went in. And I don't see the reason to be fatalistic.
Well, obviously, we're going to be watching this a lot in the weeks ahead. Ariana, if you have a last word on this, but also on how Bush is getting appreciated or not appreciated as he makes his way through Asia and Latin America as well.
Well, just very quickly, we have failed to respond to 9/11. That is really the tragic truth. We failed to respond by going after Osama bin Laden with the kind of ferocity that we went with which we went after Saddam. And that is really the catastrophic mistake we made. So when we look at our choices in Iraq, we need to look constantly at the opportunity cost. What would happen if that amount of money, those kind of resources and that kind of intensity were now directed at Osama, were directed at the heart of Al-Qaeda, as opposed to still being stuck in Iraq in a losing enterprise? Because I think that to continue to believe that we can succeed in Iraq is absolutely delusional.
Let's move to...
Let me get a last word.
Sure.
If she wanted to put all our forces going after bin Laden and his people and forget about the Iraqi situation, the two countries that we would have to send our 150,000 troops to or more would be Pakistan, where bin Laden probably is, and to go after Zarqawi, who is now expanding his operations worldwide, according to all news reports, including, I think, the New York Times. We'd have to go to where he happens to be right now, according to news reports, which is Baghdad.
all right, let's.
In other words, we don't need to move to start hunting him down.
Speaking of Bob Woodward, there was another wrinkle in the whole leak investigation in Washington this week when Bob Woodward, the celebrated investigative reporter at the Post, revealed, I guess, that he had been even before, sometime before the word had gotten to some of the other journalists involved in this inquiry, that he had been advised that Valerie Plame was a CIA operative, and now has but withheld that from his own editor. And there's lots of hand-wringing now about what this means for Woodward and journalism and the Washington Post. And Tony, what do you make of this?
Well, I mean, Woodward, I guess it's the fate of all of us to end up being mocked by our previous victories, and so he looks more Nixonian all the time. I expect him to come out. I expect him to come out soon and say that the readers of the Washington Post need to know that their assistant managing editor is not a deep throat. Well, I can tell you, I am not a deep throat. But to be half serious for half a moment, He made two statements. To me, both of them were interesting. One of the interesting statements that's got less coverage, although I did our lead editorial on it yesterday, is that he said that he probably or may have given Libby the information that about Wilson's wife, which was broadly consistent with what Libby has been saying. He said a journalist told him. And then Russett, who was believed to be the journalist, said I sure didn't, and I believe Russett, by the way. So it looked like Libby was making a material misrepresentation of fact, which is a basis for all of the charges. Now it turns out that he may have worst have been mistaken as to whether it was Woodward or Russett, and he talked to both of them within a couple of weeks of each other, and doubtlessly hundreds of other people in between, had told him that. So that's, I think, a big opportunity for the Libby defense. As far as who the other senior person is, everybody is having fun guessing who it is, and I was talking to the editor of one of the news weeklies who would not tell me, but thought that fairly soon the world would know. I don't know whether he had it or whether he just thought it was going to be out soon, but he thought that the world would soon know who the other senior official is. A lot of people have been looking at Powell or people around Powell because everybody knows that Woodward and Powell have had a remarkable working relationship for many years on a number of Woodward's books. Powell has been a major source and Powell's people, and so there's a lot of suspicion that maybe Armitage or one of Powell's people around him. Armitage has not denied that he's the other senior official, but he hasn't admitted. You know, he hasn't been. I guess he's apparently out of the country right now, which may be a convenient place to be.
Now, does that mean that if that scenario holds true, and obviously listeners would have to be somewhat familiar with the leak arcana to even follow this conversation, but we'll assume for purposes of the show, because it would take another show just to sort of set the stage again. But does that mean that Libby might have been protecting the fact that Woodward was his source in some kind of source like chivalry to the journalist? I don't know, Ariana.
No,
what do
I
you?
Don't,
what?
I don't think that would be the case.
Well, in the meantime, we also know that as we started taping the show, Fitzgerald has asked for a new grand jury. So we don't know where this is going to end in terms of the investigation. But what we do know is that this is really another big blow to what we in the blogosphere call the MSM, the mainstream media. Here is Woodward, a journalistic hero, going from Watergate hero to Plamegate goat. I mean, here he is not just not telling his editor what he knew, not just not telling his readers and his viewers, but actually going on the Larry King show, going on NPR, and trashing the Fitzgerald investigation without disclosing that he had a part to play in this whole adventure. It is really amazing. And you had him apologizing in the last couple of days for not telling his editor. But that's not the end of the story. And you have poor Downey, you know, the editor of the Washington Post, having a web discussion, an online chat today about this. And I know what they're trying to do. They're trying to sort of make this go away by being more forthcoming than the New York Times were when it came to Judy Miller. But it's not going to go away because they still haven't answered the fundamental question. I have actually 15 questions that I've asked of Bob Woodward on the Huffington Post, but here's one of the most important. What triggered his actually going to Downey to tell him that he had been the recipient of the leak? What was the trigger? That he has not yet answered.
And he's, Tony, hasn't he, but he testified just recently? Is that
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that you're getting the dates of his testimony are beyond even my Arcana database. But, Ariana, you might like the political cartoon that we ran in our paper this morning. It was a picture of a sort of a giant temple called Mainstream Media, and it's got four pillars. One of them was CBS with Dan Rather having junked it and that pillar breaking. The other is New York Times with Judy Miller's crashing into it and it breaking. And the third is the Washington Post with Woodward's cracking it, smashing into it and cracking. There's barely any pillars left, that they are destroying themselves from within.
Now, can we have permission to reprint on the Huffington Post?
Yes, you may.
Now, what does this mean for Patrick Fitzgerald? Had sort of become
$10,000 for every.
You guys can do this after the show.
For free.
Patrick Fitzgerald had become the overnight sort of poster boy for, you know, G-Man competence, et cetera. And everyone, you know, said, oh, he's just done the most thorough investigation, blah, 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 involving the Libby thing. And all of a sudden, you know, it turns out that one of the biggest Bigfoots in Washington was involved, and Fitzgerald didn't know about it, I guess, because he was too busy indicting Conrad Black, right? That's in
The lesson to learn from that is see who said in this town he did a very thorough job. Every politician and pundit who said that, you should now put a little asterisk next to and remember that they got it wrong.
But I think that would end up affecting every pundit. If you looked too closely at that for every issue, there'd be no one left standing. Ariana?
We need scorecards.
Yeah,
I
agree. Actually, I'm very for pundit accountability because I'm not a big predictor myself. So,
well, there is another issue here, which is the whole issue of journalists selling their soul for access. And that's definitely the case with Bob Woodward. I mean, he has written many very successful best-selling books. And you don't get the kind of access he has gotten without in some way trading in your press pass.
Oh, let me tell you, Ari, you're exactly right, because I dealt with him in the past. And the deal is, and I turned down the deal when I was working for Newt. He comes to you and he says, here's what other people are saying, terrible things are saying about your boss or about you. You want to give me your side. And if you give him your side, he'll put it in pretty straight. If you refuse to give your side, then all your political enemies get their line in straight. And it's a very distorted view. Whoever will participate with him gets their story told, and whoever doesn't participate with them gets scandalized. And it's a heck of a way to do journalism, if I might say.
And yet, all that I think is fair, Tony, and yet I know from meetings I was in the Clinton White House, the ability for him to recreate almost verbatim a bunch of these key sort of economic meetings is actually uncanny. And so with all the right caveats you put in, it ends up being some incredible feats of reporting.
Mike McCurry what he thinks about Woodward.
We have reached that time once again for our famed end of show, Left, Right, and Center rant featuring pet peeves from across the ideological spectrum. Just about 15, 20 seconds each. Ariana Huffington, it's your soapbox.
Well, just very quickly, I'm here in Las Vegas not to gamble, but because my friend Laurie David had her major global warming comedy extravaganza last night, which was taped with all great comedians, including, of course, her husband Larry, and which you can all see on Turner Broadcasting on Sunday, and it's a funny, hilarious, wonderful show I urge you to see.
Just about 10 seconds, Tony Blankley.
I would just say, if you go to Las Vegas not to gamble, but you go to France and not eat, I mean, you got to do a little gambling while you're there. That's great.
And in the self-interest column, I just want to urge people to look at the cover story in Fortune magazine in the new November 28th issue that my wife Jody and I have co-authored called Get a Life, which is trying to finally put firmly on the senior corporate agenda the fact that you can redesign work at the top so that people can have more meaningful lives outside of work. We have a poll in the book. We have interview in the article that shows this is not a woman's issue, it's a human issue. Men want it too. Innovators are making it happen in corporate America. This needs to be at the center of the corporate conversation because the talent wants it and business needs it. That's all the needs we have time for today on Left, Right, and Center. Thanks, as always, to Ariana Huffington and Tony Blankley. Sarah Spitz produced today's program. Our technical director is Ray Guarner, with a big thanks to David Green. I'm Matt Miller. Thanks for listening. Tune in for more Left, Right, and Center.
You got pajamas.
Well,
we know we need each other, so we better call the cooling up.
Audio archives and podcasts of KCRW programs are at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about Left, Right, and Center, email lrc@kcrw.com. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by 89.9 KCRW Santa Monica and kcrw.com.
You've been listening to KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Le Show, a weekly romp through the worlds of media, politics, sports, and show business with satirist Harry Shearer. Check out the podcast of Le Show at kcrw.com.